Mr. President and gentlemen of the convention. If we could first know where we are and whither we are tending, we could better judge what to do and how to do it. We are now far into the fifth year since a policy was initiated with the avowed object and confident purpose of putting an end to slavery agitation. Under the operation of that policy, that agitation has not only not ceased, but has constantly augmented. In my opinion, it will not cease until a crisis shall have been reached and passed. A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently half slave and half free. I do not expect the Union to be dissolved. I do not expect the House to fall. But I do expect it will cease to be divided. It will become all one thing or all the other. Either the opponents of slavery will arrest the further spread of it and place it where the public mind shall rest in the belief that it is in the course of ultimate extinction, or its advocates will push it forward till it shall become alike lawful in all the states, old as well as new, north as well as south.
Mr. President, you are now called to redress a great transgression. Seldom in the history of nations has such a question been presented. Tariffs, army bills, navy bills, land bills are important and justly occupy your care. But these all belong to the course of ordinary legislation. As means and instruments only, they are necessarily subordinate to the conservation of government itself. Grant them or deny them, in greater or less degree, and you will inflict no shock. The machinery of government will continue to move. The state will not cease to exist. Far otherwise is it with the eminent question now before you, involving as it does liberty in a broad territory, and also involving the peace of the whole country with our good name in history forevermore. Take down your map, sir, and you will find that the territory of Kansas, more than any other region, occupies the middle spot of North America, equally distant from the Atlantic on the east and the Pacific on the west, from the frozen waters of Hudson's Bay on the north, and the tepid Gulf Stream on the south, constituting the precise territorial center of the whole vast continent. To such advantages of situation, on the very highway between two oceans, are added a soil of unsurpassed richness and a fascinating undulating beauty of surface, with a health-giving climate calculated to nurture a powerful and generous people, worthy to be a central pivot of American institutions. A few short months only have passed since this spacious and Mediterranean country was open only to the savage who ran wild in its woods and prairies. And now it has already drawn to its bosom a population of free men larger than London held when on the fields of Crecy and Agincourt the English banner was carried victoriously over the chivalrous hosts of France. Against this territory, thus fortunate in position and population, a crime has been committed which is without example in the records of the past. Not in plundered provinces or in the cruelties of selfish governors will you find its parallel. And yet there is an ancient instance which may show at least the path of justice. In the terrible impeachment by which the great Roman orator has blasted through all time the name of Verres, amidst charges of robbery and sacrilege, the enormity which most aroused the indignant voice of his accuser, and which still stands forth with strongest distinctness, arresting the sympathetic indignation of all who read the story, is that away in Sicily he had scourged a citizen of Rome, that the cry, "I am a Roman citizen," had been interposed in vain against the lash of the tyrant governor. Sir, speaking in an age of light and a land of constitutional liberty, where the safeguards of elections are justly placed among the highest triumphs of civilization, I fearlessly assert that the wrongs of much abused Sicily, thus memorable in history, were small by the side of the wrongs of Kansas, where the very shrines of popular institutions, more sacred than any heathen altar, have been desecrated, where the ballot box, more precious than any work in ivory or marble from the cunning hand of art, has been plundered, and where the cry, "I am an American citizen," has been interposed in vain against outrage of every kind, even upon life itself. But the wickedness which I now begin to expose is immeasurably aggravated by the motive which prompted it. Not in any common lust for power did this uncommon tragedy have its origin. It is the rape of a virgin territory, compelling it to the hateful embrace of slavery, and it may be clearly traced to a depraved longing for a new slave state, the hideous offspring of such a crime, in the hope of adding to the power of slavery in the national government. Yes, sir, when the whole world, alike Christian and Turk, is rising up to condemn this wrong and to make it a hissing to the nations, here in our republic, force has been openly employed in compelling Kansas to this pollution, and all for the sake of political power. But this enormity, vast beyond comparison, swells to dimensions of wickedness which the imagination toils in vain to grasp, when it is understood that for this purpose are hazarded the horrors of intestine feud, not only in the distant territory, but everywhere throughout the country. Already the muster has begun, foreshadowing a strife which, unless happily averted by the triumph of freedom, will become war, fratricidal, parricidal war, with an accumulated wickedness beyond the wickedness of any war in human annals. With regret, I come upon the senator from South Carolina, Mr. Butler, who on the present in this debate overflowed with rage at the simple suggestion that Kansas had applied for admission as a state, and with incoherent phrases discharged the loose expectoration of his speech, now upon her representative, and then upon her people. He shows an incapacity of accuracy, whether in stating the Constitution or in stating the law, whether in the details of statistics or the diversion of scholarship. He cannot ope his mouth, but out there flies a blunder. But it is against the people of Kansas that the sensibilities of the senator are particularly aroused. Coming, as he announces, from a state, from South Carolina, he turns with lordly disgust from this newly formed community, which he will not recognize even as a body politic. Pray, sir, by what title does he indulge in this egotism? Has he read the history of the state which he represents? He cannot surely have forgotten its shameful imbecility from slavery, confessed throughout the Revolution, followed by its more shameful assumption for slavery since. He cannot have forgotten its Constitution, which is Republican only in name, confirming power in the hands of the few, and founding the qualifications of its legislators on a settled freehold estate and 10 Negroes. And yet the senator to whom that state has in part committed the guardianship of its good name, instead of moving with backward treading steps to cover its nakedness, rushes forward in the very ecstasy of madness to expose it by provoking a comparison with Kansas. South Carolina is old. Kansas is young. South Carolina counts by centuries, where Kansas counts by years. But a beneficent example may be born in a day, and I venture to say that against the 2 centuries of the older state may be already set the 2 years of trial, evolving corresponding virtue in the younger community. In the one is the long wail of slavery, in the other, the hymns of freedom. Ah, sir, I tell the senator that Kansas, welcomed as a free state, will be a ministering angel to the Republic when South Carolina, in the cloak of darkness which she hugs, lies howling. From Congress to the people I appeal. To the people, now on the eve of exercising the electoral franchise, in choosing a chief magistrate of the Republic, I appeal to vindicate the electoral franchise in canvas. Let the ballot box of the Union with multitudinous might protect the ballot box in that territory. Let the voters everywhere, while rejoicing in their own rights, help to guard the equal rights of distant fellow citizens, that the shrines of popular institutions now desecrated may be sanctified anew, that the ballot box now plundered may be restored, and that the cry, "I am an American citizen," may not be sent forth in vain against outrage of every kind. In the name of the Heavenly Father, whose service is perfect freedom, I make this last appeal.
I would address a few words to the Southern people. The question recurs, what will satisfy them? Simply this. We must not only let them alone, but we must somehow convince them that we do let them alone. Wrong as we think slavery is, we can yet afford to let it alone where it is, because that much is due to the necessity arising from its actual presence in the nation. But can we, while our votes will prevent it, allow it to spread into the national territories and to overturn us here in these free states? If our sense of duty forbids this, then let us stand by our duty fearlessly and effectively. All they ask, we could readily grant, if we thought slavery right. All we ask, they could as readily grant, if they thought it wrong. Their thinking it right and our thinking it wrong is the precise fact upon which depends the whole controversy. Thinking it right as they do, they are not to blame for desiring its full recognition as being right. But thinking it wrong as we do, can we yield to them? Can we cast our votes with their view and against our own? Let us have faith that right makes right. And in that faith, let us, to the end, dare to do our duty as we understand it.
Mr. President and Senators, the success of the abolitionists and their allies under the name of the Republican Party has produced its logical results already. They have for long years been sowing dragon's teeth and have finally got a crop of armed men. The Union, sir, is dissolved. That is an accomplished fact in the path of this discussion that men may as well heed. And while the perfidious authors of this mischief are showering down denunciations upon a large portion of the patriotic men of this country, those brave men are coolly and calmly voting what you call revolution. I, sir, doing better than that, arming to defend it. They appeal to the Constitution. They appeal to justice. They appeal to fraternity. Until the Constitution, justice, and fraternity were no longer listened to, in the legislative halls of their country. And then, sir, they prepared for the arbitrament of the sword. And now you see the glittering bayonet, and you hear the tramp of armed men from your capital to the Rio Grande. It's a sight that gladdens the eyes and cheers the heart of other millions ready to second them. Inasmuch, sir, as I have labored earnestly, honestly, sincerely with these men to avert this necessity so long as I deemed it possible, and inasmuch as I heartily approve their present conduct of resistance, I deem it my duty to state their case to the Senate, to the country, and to the civilized world. Senators, my countrymen have demanded no new government. They've demanded no new constitution. Look to their records at home and here, from the beginning of this national strife until its consummation in the disruption of the empire, and they have not demanded a single thing except that you shall abide by the Constitution of the United States. That constitutional right shall be respected, and that justice shall be done. Sirs, they have stood by your Constitution. They have performed all its duties unselfishly, uncalculatingly, disinterestedly, until a party sprang up in this country which endangered their social system. A party which they arraigned, and which they charged before the American people and all mankind with having made proclamation of outlawry against 4,000 millions of their property in the territories of the United States, with having put them under the ban of the empire in all the states in which their institutions exist, outside the protection of federal laws, with having aided and abetted insurrection from within and invasion from without, with the view of subverting those institutions and desolating their homes and their firesides. For these causes, they have taken up arms. I shall not spend much time on the question that seems to give my honorable friend Mr. Crittenden so much concern, the constitutional right of a state to secede from the Union. Perhaps he'll find out after a while that it's a fact accomplished. You've got it in the South pretty much both ways. South Carolina's given it to you regularly, according to the approved plan. You're getting it just below there in Georgia, I believe, irregularly. Outside the law, without regular action. You can take it either way. You will find armed men to defend both. I have stated that the discontented states of this Union have demanded nothing but clear, distinct, unequivocal, well-acknowledged constitutional rights. We demand no power to injure any man. We demand no right to interfere with their institutions, either by word or deed. We have no right to disturb their peace, their tranquility, their security. We've demanded of them simply, solely, nothing else, to give us equality, security, and tranquility. Give us these and peace restores itself. Refuse them and take what you get. What do these rebels demand? First, that the people of the United States shall have an equal right to emigrate and settle in the present or any future acquired territories, with whatever property they may possess, including slaves, and be securely protected in its peaceable enjoyment until such territory may be admitted as a state into the Union with or without slavery, as she may determine on an equality with all existing states. That is our territorial demand. We fought for this territory when blood was its price. We have paid for it when gold was its price. We have not proposed to exclude you, though you've contributed very little blood or money. I refer especially to New England. The second proposition, is that property in slaves shall be entitled to the same protection from the government of the United States in all of its departments, everywhere, which the Constitution confers the power upon it to extend to any other property. We demand of the common government to use its granted powers to protect our property as well as yours. For this protection, we pay as much as you do. This very property is subject to taxation. It's been taxed by you and sold by you for taxes. The title to thousands and tens of thousands of slaves is derived from the United States. We claim that the government, while the Constitution recognizes our property for the purposes of taxation, shall give it the same protection as it gives yours. Ought it not to be so? You say no. Every one of you upon this committee said no. Your senator said no. Your House of Representatives said no. Throughout the length and breadth of your conspiracy against the Constitution, there is but one shout of no. This recognition of this right is the price of my allegiance. Withhold it, and you do not get my obedience. This is the philosophy of the armed men who have sprung up in this country. Do you ask me to support a government that will tax my property, that will plunder me, that will demand my blood, and will not protect me? I'd rather see the population of my native state laid 6 feet beneath her sod than that they should support for 1 hour such a government. We demand in the next place that persons committing crimes against slave property in one state and fleeing to another shall be delivered up in the same manner as persons committing crimes against other property, and that the laws of the state from which such persons flee shall be the test of criminality. That's another one of the demands of an extremist and a rebel. The Constitution of the United States, Article 4, Section 2, says, a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. But the non-slaveholding states, treacherous to their oaths and compacts, have steadily refused if the criminal only stole a Negro, and that Negro was a slave, to deliver him up. It's natural that we should want this provision of the Constitution carried out. The Constitution says slaves are property. The Supreme Court says so. The Constitution says so. The theft of slaves is a crime. They are subject matter of felonious transportation. By the text and the letter of the Constitution, you've agreed to give them up. You've sworn to do it, and you've broken your oaths. The Constitution of the United States now requires and gives Congress express power to define and punish piracies and felonies committed on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. When the honorable and distinguished senator from Illinois, Mr. Douglas, last year introduced a bill for the purpose of punishing people thus offending under that clause of the Constitution, Mr. Lincoln, in his speech at New York, which I have before me, declared that it was a sedition bill. His press and party hooted at it. So far from recognizing the bill as intended to carry out the Constitution of the United States, it received their jeers and jibes. The black Republicans of Massachusetts elected the admirer and eulogist of John Brown's courage as their governor, and we may suppose he will throw no impediments in the way of John Brown's successors. The epithet applied to the bill of the senator from Illinois is quoted from a deliberate speech delivered by Lincoln in New York, for which it was stated in the journals, according to some resolution passed by an association of his own party, he was paid $200. The speech should, therefore, have been deliberate. Lincoln denounced that bill. He places the stamp of his condemnation upon a measure intended to promote the peace and security of Confederate states. He is therefore an enemy of the human race and deserves the execration of all mankind. The Supreme Court have decided that by the Constitution. We have a right to go to the territories and be protected there with our property. You say we cannot decide the compact for ourselves. Well, can the Supreme Court decide it for us? Mr. Lincoln says he does not care what the Supreme Court decides. He says this in his debate with the honorable member from Illinois, Mr. Douglas. I have it before me. He said he would vote against the decision of the Supreme Court. Then you did not accept that, arbiter. You will not take my construction. You will not take the Supreme Court as an arbiter. And you will not take the practice of the government. You will not take the treaties under Jefferson and Madison. You will not take the opinion of Madison upon the very question of prohibition in 1820. What then will you take? You will take nothing but your own judgment. That is, you will not only judge for yourselves, not only discard the court, discard our construction, discard the practice of the government, but you will drive us out simply because you will it. Come and do it. You have sapped the foundations of society. You have destroyed almost all hope of peace. In a compact where there is no common arbiter, where the parties finally decide for themselves, the sword alone at last becomes the real, if not the constitutional, arbiter. Your party says that you will not take the decision of the Supreme Court. You said so at Chicago. You said so in committee. Every man of you in both houses said so. But what are you going to do? You say we shall submit to your construction. We shall do it if you can make us, but not otherwise or in any other manner. That is settled. You may call it secession or you may call it revolution, but there is a big fact standing before you ready to oppose you, and that fact is free men with arms in their hands. The cry of the Union will not disperse them. We have passed that point. They demand equal rights, and you had better heed their demand.